32 item, you can't do it.
Very fancy. As you can tell, a hell of a lot of ham radio operators would love to work in the broadcast industry, sitting in front of a microphone and transmitting their really valuable thoughts that they think they've got, or manning the transmitters and receivers, and manning the television and lighting and audio and cameras and so on. Lots and lots of hams would love to be in the broadcast world. Eric's one of those guys where his hobby and his business have been one and the same for a whole lot of years. He's fun to talk to about these crazy subjects. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
Okay, Dick, well, it looks like this gentleman's got a lot to think about before he goes there. And I agree with Eric 100% what he said about those lip meter guys with power mics. They have no idea what they're doing, and they do sound terrible. I particularly do not like L-pads, even the high-quality ones. They get noisy after a while. I've always used either inductive or resistive switching on a wafer switch, and it works perfectly, and you can set up the impedance any way you want, and you can control those speakers beautifully. I just don't care for L-pads. They're just a waste of time to me. But a lot of people use them, and they've been using them for years. That's about it from Mel's Corner, Dick. Got them all done and all answered pretty promptly. So they got their work cut out for them. Back to you, Dick.
Comment.
Okay, that sounds like it could be Vito. Could be A2PJF, if that's who it was. K2RIW.
No, Dick. Good evening, Dick. I'm listening to the whole thing. It's very fascinating this evening. But if another gentleman is calling you, it wasn't me. Go ahead.
Okay, who was it with comments?
Ed, K2GJE.
Go right ahead, Ed.
I saw audio distribution done different for public address. They had a amplifier that had the 70.7 volt output, and at each speaker they had a transformer with a 70.7 volt input, and on the secondary they had what they call power taps, and they had a switch to adjust volume. Back to net.
Yeah, that sounds like a very nice way of doing it, where you switch in steps, and therefore you don't have the scratching pot noise that that John has run into. John, when you end up with that scratchy sound of the L pads that you have used, does anyone ever put the right kind of tuner cleaner or whatever in there, and does it make improvement, or is the problem that when you do that, it only lasts for a couple of days, and then it goes right back to the scratchy noise? Over to you, John.
Dick, we found the silicone spray was the best lubricant to put in, and it did take it out for a while. But inherently, they're just noisy. Wire pots are horrible. And especially when you're installing this in a luxurious entertainment area, and the guy goes over to adjust it, and everybody's having dinner or something, and they hear that. They don't like it. So we went to inductive transformers and resistors, and that solved the problem.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, actually, in the professional audio world, in the 50s and the 60s, they got around the noisy pot problem simply by not making pots. The faders on radio consoles and in recording consoles were basically a series of contacts, and each contact had a resistor that was part of a lattice. The way the contacts were arranged, it was a make and break, so you would never hear a click of them. Today, of course, we use linear faders, but we actually control voltage-controlled amplifiers with them, so we tend to get away from the noise issue, too, in the professional stuff. But, good old contact cleaners, it works great in pots for a little while until they generate more dirt, because usually the carbon wipers or the piece of contact that would sit against the carbon would wear little etches into the carbon, and you clean them, they'd be nice and clean for about a week or so, and then they start making all sorts of clapping noises again. K2RIW, K2JX.
Now, the tap transformer sounds like a fairly nice way to go. The resistive lattice network you described is a fairly nice way to go. Has anyone ever done it with something like a variac transformer? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, well, as the other gentleman was saying, But you kept saying 70 ohms, and I say 70 volts. The actual impedance to the 70 volt line was something like, I think it was 180 ohms. And typically the 70 volt line would feed speakers. Each speaker would have a primary of 70, 120 ohms or 180 ohms, which would take the 70 volt line. The output would actually come down to 8 ohms. The L pad would be at 8 ohms, and that would be the individual volume control, was one method. Another method was that they would make transformers with multiple taps in the secondary. There was basically a switch that would switch between the taps of the secondary to give you the different different levels of voltage, which would give you the different volumes in the speaker.
So nobody did it with a variac where, in other words, the secondary winding could be moved with reference to the primary winding and its magnetic field. So nobody did it as a continuous magnetic circuit. Is that true, Eric?
In the recording world, they tried doing that, but it never worked out very well. There were always secondary harmonic distortion factors which would occur at different various positions of the variac, which is really an auto transformer.
Yes, I can see that happening. To try to make it flat in frequency response, at the same time you're making massive changes to the magnetic flux flow direction across the primary and or secondary, I can see how nasty things are going to happen. Very similar to the exotic shaping that's required between the poles of an armature and the stator of a brushless DC motor. To really make the motor efficient requires some exotic shaping of what happens to the magnetic field during each degree of rotation of that armature. Let's see if Paul is available. WS2N, I wonder if you're on frequency tonight. K2RIW.
Yes, we're here. How you doing, Dick? I have just really one topic I wanted to cover.
You sound good, and please proceed.
I know we talked about it in the past, the launch of the Dragon and Falcon 9 rocket is coming up next Monday, actually, at 12:22 p.m. commercial launch. I've talked about it before, but I just wanted to bring up a couple of points that I really haven't talked about in the past. First of all, to review it, in case people are wondering what I'm talking about if they haven't heard it, it's commercial launch by SpaceX. They've launched a couple of rockets before. They launched a Falcon 9 as a test with a dummy capsule on top. And then subsequently, in December of last year, they launched the Falcon 9 rocket again, but this time with the Dragon capsule on top. And it went around two orbits, and it came back and landed successfully in the Pacific Ocean. They recovered it. It's a recoverable reflight spacecraft, and it will be able to carry people, and will carry cargo at first. Let me drop it. The Dragon spacecraft will eventually carry up to seven people. They'll put four on, like, the top area, and then below them there'll be three more, so a total of seven. Or, you know, a smaller setup. Maybe they might just send up two astronauts, except they'll have a larger cargo. You know, the idea is to bring cargo and people up to the space station. But this one's going to be the first one, the first commercial flight to go to the International Space Station. Different governments have sent up their own commercial flight, their own payloads for supplies, but nobody sent up a commercial flight. This will be number one. It'll be going on Monday. Let me drop it. When in operation, and at one time they did mention that they're going to have about 12 flights per year. And this will be number one. And because the first one, they're not going to load it up with supplies, they'll be able to carry up to 13,000 pounds up to the space station. This time they're only going to bring up 1,200 pounds of non-important supplies. It's really a test flight, but they'll bring some stuff up, and they will bring some stuff down. Another 1,200 pounds of scientific equipment and whatever will be put on board and landed in the Pacific. What's interesting about this whole setup is the Falcon 9, and the reason they call it 9, by the way, is they have 9 rockets on the bottom. If you look at the bottom of the spacecraft, there's 9 rockets sticking out. That's what puts this thing out of space. And then a second stage will have one of those rockets. And it's the exact same type, so it keeps the cost down. They run kerosene and they run liquid oxygen. One or two engines could fail and they could still reach orbit. This is WS2M. Let me drop it. So the idea is to have this thing reusable. They'll be able to bring it back and send it back up again. But what's interesting in the future is they plan on having retro rockets on board the spacecraft. So let's say you bring cargo back or people back, this thing will come down, and the animation shows it without a parachute. It's kind of hard to believe, but they show it without a parachute actually landing with retro rockets from orbit. So that's part of the plan. And then another part of the plan is to bring back not only the first stage and vertically, it's going to fly one single rocket coming back down, and it'll land and be able to be reused. They plan on doing it for the second stage as well. They'll separate from the Dragon spacecraft, and the second stage will fly a couple of rockets, will turn itself around, and then on the front of it, it has an ablative heat shield. And that'll deorbit using the heat shield. And naturally, it's more complicated than the first stage. You've got to have all kinds of communications equipment on board, autonomous operation on the drop it. Plan on eventually landing this thing on solid ground. So all three will eventually be recoverable and reusable, first stage, second stage, and the Dragon spacecraft itself. So pretty interesting deal. I have one question for you, Dick, because once they get in operation, by the way, the return of these first and second stages won't happen until, the earliest that will happen would be around the sixth flight. So, you've got quite a bit of time before that ever happens. But the payload going up is roughly 13,000 pounds fully loaded when in operation, and not the 1,200 pounds like I mentioned this time. On the way back, it'll be about 6,000, a little over 6,000 pounds. I was wondering the physics behind it. How can they bring up 13,000 pounds, and they can only bring back about half of that weight maximum? So, back to you, Dick, WS2M.
Before I get into your question, Paul, I'm a little uncomfortable with backing back down. During that backing back down and landing with retro rocket power, if any of those rockets fail at that time, there is no very graceful recovery unless you've got an escape pod. Does the Dragon have some kind of a crew escape pod in case there is a failure during that back down operation? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, they have rockets near the top of the thing. It doesn't look like the old Saturn V Apollo setup with the rocket mounted on top of the spacecraft, and it would fire it. Separate from everything, and parachutes coming out, but it does have like rockets. It looks like it's blended in with the frame of the whole capsule. And these things would fire during an emergency, let's say if something failed, either the parachutes or the retro rockets coming down all the way to ground, and these things would fire and give them some lift, and then you'd have drogue parachutes. It's actually three sets. The drogue will come out, and then I think another single parachute comes out, and then from that, three main parachutes come out there.
Now, when you take off with 13,000 pounds, if I understand correctly, it is a three-stage rocket. When you come back down, it's a one-stage rocket. If that's true, if I've guessed correctly on that one, now, Paul, that would be a strong indication of why the amount of load you can have that you bring back down is a hell of a lot smaller than the load that you can bring up. I think you said 13,000 pounds can go up, but only 6,000 can come back down. And I'm guessing this one single stage that's landing, it's not a three-stage rocket anymore. I think that's a strong contributing factor. Is that possible, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it would be a series of retro rockets coming down. So not one rocket. It's surrounding the spacecraft at the bottom of it. It's got landing legs that come out. It's unbelievable. But for now, the earlier flights, they'll land them in the Pacific Ocean like they did in December, which was successful. I mean, they landed right near the pickup ship. But even that, you know, they can only bring back half the amount of weight that goes up. And in that case, they use parachutes 100%. No retro rockets at the end. So it's still, you know, half the weight coming back no matter where they go, water or land. So there's multiple rockets coming down to land on land, or just landing in the Pacific. So that's what's kind of weird. The energy is all used up. Coming back with the heat shield. Let me drop it. No worries. That's going to slow them down. So that makes up for the difference of all the thrust that took to put them up there. You know, all the energy is dissipated through reentry. So that's why I figured, well, you know, it should be about the same amount of weight going down as going up. So that's why I was wondering about it. I figured anybody that asked a physics type of question, you'd have a shot at it. I didn't see anything on the internet. I checked into it. It just shows, you know, payload going up, weight coming down.
Possible answer, Dick?
Plan to bring a lot of stuff back. I mean, eventually they're going to have people, but there's a lot of scientific equipment and heavy stuff that has to come back, which nobody has the capability of doing that right now. Drop it. These H2 goes up there, brings stuff up. They load it up with garbage, burns up over the Pacific. The Russian Progress, the ship goes up there. Same thing, burns up over the Pacific. They load it up with garbage, becomes a garbage freighter, really. And even the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle by European Space Agency, which is huge. Same thing, that thing doesn't return either. The only thing that had the capability of returning was the space shuttle. And now the Dragon, eventually the Orion spacecraft, and something being built called the Dream Chaser. A couple of years away, a lot of years away on that. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to pick up with John for a minute, in a minute. One of the points I was going to make went straight out of my head. KC2 WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2 WGB. Dick, is it possible that the atmospheric drag and the size of the heat shield is just not sufficiently large enough to give them enough braking to carry all of that weight? They can only handle that weight because of the drag in the atmosphere.
That's half of it from my point of view, John. As you put more and more weight that's being re-entered, you have to burn up more and more ablative heat shield in the process of re-entering the atmosphere, because all of that kinetic energy of that greater amount of mass has to be decelerated from 17,500 miles an hour, the orbital speed, down to something nearly zero. That's one factor. A second factor is when they take off with 13,000 pounds, 13,000 pounds, that first stage rocket has got a whole lot of rocket motors doing all that lifting. When they come back down, if they tried to come back down with 13,000 pounds, on that third capsule, third module, is nowhere near that number of rocket motors. Yeah, you're not lifting as much weight because an awful lot of the energy dissipated coming back down is the heat shield. Yeah, I don't have the whole story. There's one other thing that's bothering me, Paul, and that is in the early days of the space bus that's called Space Shuttle, I think they were fairly sure they're going to make a launch every month, 12 launches per year. For a whole bunch of reasons, that was very difficult to pull off. Here we are with the Falcon 9 and Dragon claiming that they're eventually going to get up to 12 flights per year. In your mind, is that possible that that could be a little overly ambitious? WS2N, K2RIW.
Normally I would say yes, but right now, these people are actually under budget. They put out, you know, for a private corporation, they put out all their funds, you know, what NASA's giving them and how much money they're making, and they're pretty open. And they're under budget. Each launch is fully loaded, will be, I think it was $52 million, which is pretty good. They can compete against the Chinese. Chinese equip them more to launch their rockets. So the company's got the technology, and they have all kinds of shortcuts and good communications between the thousands of people that are involved with this company, hiring people. And right now, 12 a year, well, not now, but I mean, you know, in the future they'll be doing 12 a year. That's their predicted number. Space Shuttle, they made a prediction. Let me drop it. Their shuttles were designed for 100 flights for 30 years. You know, figured they would last about 30 years, which they did. But each one was supposed to last about 100 flights, and they were going to eventually build more shuttles and had all kinds of big plans. But yeah, they were planning once every 2 or 3 weeks, they thought the shuttles were going to be going. And they thought they were going to have 25 flights a year. Of course, that didn't happen. I think the most they ever had was, I think, 8 rings of the bell. They did get up that high before the Challenger disaster. So, that was government. This is a private corporation. So far, they're living up to where, let me drop it. Thing. They were supposed to have, for instance, before this flight, they were supposed to have another test orbital flight. Well, the last one went so well, you know, they went up there and they showed they had maneuvering capabilities, did all the stuff that they wanted to do there. Solar panels coming out of it and all, and plus it came back. Back where it was supposed to, that NASA said, you know what, good enough, next one, you go right to the space station. So not only are they ahead of budget, you know, within budget, they're ahead of a predicted schedule, practically.
Sorry for the delay, I was waiting for my computer to catch up with my demands. Okay. We'll see. When you said next Monday,
show it.
When you said next Monday, does that mean Monday a week from tomorrow? Does that mean April 30th? Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, April 30th, 12:22 in the afternoon. And I'm sure the news stations will carry that. That's, you know, the first commercial flight to the space station. That's pretty good. If you go to SpaceX.com, SpaceX,
the word SpaceX is one word, you know, there's no SpaceX.com. And, well, right now anyway, this week, bottom lower left-hand corner is a picture. And I think it said our reusable system or something like that. And you click on that, and it's a three-minute video of the three main components of the whole deal. There's the Falcon 9 spacecraft, which you'll see the first and second stages, how they return to Earth. The first stage, of course, doesn't have an ablative heat shield. That just comes back and lands vertically. Second stage does have the heat shield, because that makes it out of space. That turns around, uses the heat shield, and gives it a 180, and that thing lands vertically as well. And so does the Dragon spacecraft, so it's pretty interesting. Thank you.
Good stuff, Paul. Oh, will the liftoff take place from the Kennedy Space Center, or is there a different launch location? Back to you, Paul.
This one, like the last one, will be launched from the Kennedy Space Center. And you'll see the four gigantic towers surrounding it, you know, so lightning, you know, protection and all. You'll see that. The company does have capability and money invested in the launch facility at Vandenberg Air Force Base, as well as Kwajalein Island out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Question for Paul.
And will that launch take place from Launch Pad 39A? In 1972, I stood on Launch Pad 39A and got locked in there one night, but that's another whole story. Back to you, Paul, and then turn it over to John. You got it, Paul.
39A, I think that was the Apollo launches, but the, you know, that was all scrapped, and then that became 39A, 39B, were launch facilities for the shuttle. This is going off right next to it. In other words, there's got to be a dozen launch complexes down there, and it's the one, I think, next to where the shuttle used to take off. And now over to John. How you doing, John? WSUI.
KC2WGV. Good to hear you in there, Paul. Paul, I have a question for you. You may not know the answer. Maybe you do. I was watching the program, and I'm sure you're familiar with the spacesuit they were designing preferably for Mars. It's a fully articulated suit with universal joints. You climb in through the back, and it's like a hatch that closes. But what I found astounding was that suit, $12 million. Could that be right? Over to you, Paul.
I'm just trying to think of the cost. The cost has dropped phenomenally. The original spaces, each one was designed for whatever astronaut was wearing them. That's the way it went. But then when the shuttle came along, and the International Space Station, of course, they have a certain amount of different size suits, and each one is adaptable to each astronaut. They have different ways of tightening them up, for the intermediate sizes. So whatever the costs are, it could be $12 million. I don't know, but I know that if they were $30 million. During the Apollo days, they're half of that now, so I guess it could be $12 million, John. Probably sounds about right. What you're describing, of course, in the future, for Mars, when you drop it. Russians have that exact system. The Americans, we've always had this system where the bottom part is put on trousers, you know, that's put on, and then the top part goes over, you know, at your stomach area. This gigantic slip rings that connect, and then slip rings are all over, you know, your wrist and your elbows and all. That's the American design. The Russian design, they call them the All-In Spaces. All-In,
the back. It's one piece, if you were to look at it. And they climb in, feet first, and then they put the head in, and then they close up the back. That's basically a Russian design. They'll probably go with it.
Okay, very good. Back to you, Dick.
Now, John, we've got at least two or three subjects that we can discuss right now. One, we can continue discussing your Faraday shield, either now or a little bit delayed. Number two, I'm kind of fascinated by this magnetic particle clutch thing that made by the Warner Company, I think it is, that brought to our attention by Warner, W-A-R-N-E-R Company. Magnetic particle clutch and brake that was brought to our attention by Wesley. When have you had a chance to see that email? I wonder if you can explain. I believe I can explain how it works and why it's so linear. I wonder if you've seen that and what your feeling on that one is, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Dick, I still have one last comment on the basic KC2QIQ before you start the new subject.
You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, just an interesting comment about SpaceX. I think one thing that has to be pointed out is that this still is a 100% funded government project. So in other words, there's no out of pocket expenses here by SpaceX. So in other words, all of this is really being funded directly on U.S. government dollars. Another interesting thing about SpaceX is that there are no government employees. So in other words, everyone who works for SpaceX actually is employed by them as a separate company. So really the difference here is that there's no government limitations on what they're doing other than the cost and the schedule. So it's a very interesting, program to see how this really turns out. You know, can a private contractor actually do the job of NASA, but at lesser cost and expense with non-government employees? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, that is a fancy question. However, by it being funded that way, the chances of success are much higher. If you and I had to be a thoroughly privately funded company doing something this big, and we're talking about lots of megabucks here, and if it had to be our own funding, and if our own funding ran a little bit shy, and therefore you couldn't follow through to make it work at the very end, and the United States was completely abandoning its launch capability of the space shuttle with no fallback, I see a high risk in that, if you know what I mean. So if you were in Congress and deciding how to fund NASA and this SpaceX company, would you try to do it another way, and do you think you could make it successful? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Honestly, Dick, I think it's out of my scope of understanding, but I'm looking at this as a very, very interesting experiment, so to speak, because here again, NASA, they've always been a government body, and but what's interesting there is that they're really all government employees. Everyone who worked for NASA was really a government employee in one way or another, and the difference here is that NASA still has the goals and the mission statements that they've had before. It's just that now they're not hands-on anymore. In other words, now a private contractor is giving the funding that would have been available directly to NASA and, doing it in-house. But now basically what they're doing is they're just controlling the schedule and the funding. So it's daring. But so far is so good, right? I mean, it's looking good so far. So we'll just have to really wait and see to really get the answers that you're asking. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Dick, WS2N, one comment.
You got it, Paul.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, but I think it could work. They've been doing it for years with, they call it USA, United Space Alliance. At one time, the launch facility was all, NASA employees. That's been privatized for years now. Oh, I think about 7 years, maybe longer, I don't know. But, called the United Space Alliance.
the whole group that's involved with the launching of this thing is now officially private money.
If I was an employee building a federal road, and I worked for the, I think I'd be working for the U.S. Department of Transportation, but there I'm not sure. Technically, I am a federal employee. If I'm a enlisted person in the armed services, without a doubt, I'm a federal employee. I'm an employee of the Department of Defense. But NASA has always been a non-military organization, to my knowledge. I mean, when you watch that old program on television called I Dream of Jeannie, and all of those NASA employees on that program wore these military-looking uniforms, NASA doesn't have that. NASA really is a commercial organization funded by the United States government, funded by your and my taxpaying money. So this SpaceX organization, from that point of view, is not that different. But still, any lesser way of funding it, I think, would guarantee failure as I see it, Paul. Because, I mean, John, here we go, Glenn, because we're talking about huge expenses here in order to get this thing rolling. And until you make a whole lot of launches, you're not going to get payback. I mean, if this was a purely independent commercial organization, and if you and I sat down and tried to plan on return on investment from the original research, development, design, construction, building your own launch facilities, building all of the hardware, and doing the launches, it wouldn't be until, let me pick a number, 10 or 15 launches downrange, where you're charging lots of megabucks for each launch and each payload that you deliver. It'd be a whole lot of launches downrange before you'd be getting return on investment. And that's going to be a good fraction of a decade downrange. If you and I went to a venture capitalist and we told him, I've got this great idea, but you're not going to get return on investment for a decade, I guarantee he would say, get the heck out of here. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Oddly enough, though, Dick, this company, SpaceX, is not formed by the government. Keep that in mind. So apparently there were originally investors and people who put their sweat and blood into this company and came up with many of these ideas long before they were able to create a contract with the government to take this project over. So eventually what happened was apparently they had enough smarts and enough people on board where they could convince NASA and the federal government and the powers that be that they deserved the contract and that they were capable of doing it. So, yeah, there was some initial investment there. But I guess the point that I was making before about the federal dollars is that this program and this contract is 100% government funded. So, in other words, from here, you know, forward, but in other words, before they got that contract, it originally was on their own nickel. It's just that now, it's from here forward, this is really a government program, except no government employees. You know, it's rare that you see a contract that large given to a private contractor that's going to fund it all the way through. I mean, certainly there's been contracts to Rockwell and other companies for hardware before, but this is the whole program. They're astronauts, they're everything. KTRW, KC2QIQ.
I'm going to again guess that NASA, 10 or so years ago, put out a request for proposal, an RFP or an RFQ, and SpaceX is one of the companies that, with their venture capital funding at that time, came up with enough research and a viable enough sounding proposal that NASA, in their selecting capability, NASA and or government, in their selecting capability, said, yes, I think these guys have got it. I think they can pull it off. They've got enough smarts in their particular organization, and they're the main one that we should fund. And let me ask this to Paul. Paul, do you know of SpaceX is now being funded, we're fairly sure, from what Glenn is telling us, and you can probably confirm this, being funded by taxpayer money. When it comes to NASA requesting a proposal from various commercial organizations that are going to take over the launch and payload and recovery and whatever of things going to the International Space Station as well as other space vehicles. When NASA put out that request for proposal, was there more than one viable sounding company? Are they funding more than one? Or is SpaceX the one that's getting 90% of the funding right now, and some others are possibly coming up a little bit later? WS2N, K2RIW.
Quite a few. I have a list somewhere. Number years ago when that first came out, find it. But for instance, Bigelow, this guy, he's going to build inflatable modules. You instead of bringing up a big module, he was being funded to make these things. He's having some success. He flew a demonstration model, a very small version of it. So it would turn into this gigantic living area. You could attach it to a space station or whatever you want to do. And you could bring up tourists. He had that idea. So he was funded partially for that. Orbital Sciences is another one. It was trying to develop equipment to go up to the space station. Then there was another company, and they were building something called the Dream Chaser. It looks like a small shuttle. I forgot the name of the company. I can find the name of that. But they dropped them. They weren't doing too good. In fact, they were going to drop the program. And I believe it was Orbital Sciences that picked it up now. And because they have more money involved and more experience in that company, NASA said, okay, now they continue to fund that. So eventually you're going to have, let me drop it. Private corporations. You'll have Orbital Sciences and SpaceX going up to the space station. Orbital Sciences would have the Dream Chasers. Looks like a small space shuttle. In fact, it will come back and land on the ground. It could land on any runway. You don't need this 3-mile long runway that they had out in White Sands in California or down in Florida. You could land it at Kennedy. So it's going to be small. You can put 7 astronauts on board. Really not much cargo. So that's under development. It's still being funded. It's just that SpaceX is way ahead of everybody else. I mean, they've got launches under their belt, and they've also got one coming up at the end of the month. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I wonder how they got that far ahead. Now, go ahead, John.
Dick, maybe you'll remember, there was a $10 million prize that I think SpaceX won for a specific design that NASA offered that prize for. I think that's how they got their start, if I remember correctly.
Interesting. Okay. So a week from tomorrow at 12:22 in the afternoon, hopefully on some of the good websites we can go to, we'll be able to see that launch. And by going to SpaceX.com, one word, SpaceX.com, we'll see pictures of this craft, the launch vehicles, the various stages, and so on. Brand new era in space coming along. I still get amazed at how often people talking about space, thoroughly informed people, talk about going to the space shuttle, going to the moon, going to the Mars, and beyond. And I'm reasonably sure that's going to be an awful long time before we go to Mars. Tremendous resources required to do it, and you don't get enough in return. The moon, maybe. Mars, I'm very doubtful on that one. And the chances of bringing back those astronauts alive, I think, are, with current technology, very, very slim. It would take funding of all the major nations in the world to try to pull it off. And each one of them is going to say, what do I get in return? We're not doing this for pride. I mean, in the case of the space race to go to the moon, one of our strong motivations was to do it during the Cold War, before the Soviet Union did it. there isn't that kind of a competition these days. And not everyone's happy. We developed a lot of good hardware and technology in the process of solving the problem of getting a man to the moon and back. So, and that was American dollars being spent on primarily American companies. So it generated a lot of good business and a lot of good technology, and apparently helped us leapfrog what integrated circuits and computers can do, and nose cones and boosters and hydraulic pumps and spacesuits and all kinds of things benefit from all of that research. But I don't think you get anywhere near the same bang for the dollar on going to Mars. You wouldn't get the... You'd be spending a thousand times more dollars, and I don't think you're going to get a thousand times more fallout from it, so to speak. So it may not be cost-effective.
KC2QAQ with a comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Glenn with my list.
Go ahead, Glenn, and then we'll go over to Rob Paul. You got it, Glenn.
Sorry, Paul, but Dick, I'm not as skeptical about some of these possible dreams moving forward. And the reason why I say that is because there's a lot of very, very strong American ingenuity here in this country, untapped resources, that you sprinkle the dollars in the right place and great things will happen. And I think, unfortunately, what happened with NASA is that over the years, it just became a very, very bloated type of thing where people's ideas and dreams were getting crushed within that organization. I hate to say it, but it's true. I think that really did happen. And I think here moving forward with this privatization and taking it out from underneath the crush, so to speak, of government oversight. I mean, oversight is good from the very, very top end, but not from the point of ideas and development of things. And I think that with these private companies, many of the things that today look like they're impossible can become possible. And that's the hope for tomorrow, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
On that note, Glenn, with your more optimistic view, what do you believe is the probability and how much time will it take for an astronaut to be standing on the moon, on Mars? Over to you, Glenn.
One carefully placed paradigm, and it happens very, very quickly, Dick. It's just when that one idea hits and everybody sees it, it all can happen. But sometimes in a government organization, a paradigm can get really buried in the mud. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
But the major impediment from my point of view is all of the consumable substances required to maintain the life of a human being. Tremendous thousands of pounds of stuff are being brought up to the space station every month or so in order to maintain those astronauts, bringing them oxygen, food, water, and other supplies. You can't do that on a 2-year or a 3-year trip to Mars. You've heard my explanation of the amount of consumables that Glenn Marchione would consume within 1 year. I think you've heard my estimation of that, haven't you, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I sure have, Dick, but there's been other ideas placed forward, and I'm just putting them, you know, okay, if you put, say, the astronauts into a deep sleep, that would be one way of doing it, and they can control consumables that way. Not to say that that's how it would be done. Then you see other, you know, ideas of things that are outlandish to say today, and complete science fiction, a replicator. Are these things possible? I think anything is possible, Dick. If given the right amount of time and the right amount of thought and putting it together, as I said, one paradigm, you know, where you have a big shift and change in the way of thinking, and wow, amazing things can happen. So, you know, if you were to look back in the 40s and the 50s and say, could you create a rocket to send 3 astronauts safely into orbit and put 2 of them on the moon? People would have laughed. And that was just a space of, what, 20, 25 years? Tops? K2RIW, KC2QIQ. We better pass this over to Paul. I think he's waiting.
Yeah, I used to read those books by Willie Ley and Werner von Braun. One of them was called Rocket Spaceships. Can't even go. Rockets, something, and Spaceships. But Collier Magazine had a lot of pictures in the let me think now, late 40s, early 50s, about space flight. So it was being dreamed about in fairly realistic ways a long time ago. Go ahead, Paul, I think it is next.
I found my list one. List from when they first started handing out contracts or trying to size up who was going to do these flights. There's a list of 15. I'm not going to read them all, but I'll read some of the ones that some people might know. Virgin Galactic, that's Richard Branson. He was the one with Spaceship One, Spaceship Two. They're involved with some private funding. You got SpaceX, of course, that's one that's going up. Talks about Orbital Sciences. They had a $1.9 billion. At the time, SpaceX had a $1.6 billion less than Orbital Sciences, but it looks like SpaceX is beating Orbital Sciences out by a mile. You have Scaled Composites, that's the one developed by Burton Tan. He's involved with the... I think he's kind of like involved with that Virgin Galactic now, since they kind of get together. There's companies called Mason Space Systems, and they have plans for a lunar lander. Planetary Society, they were involved, but they had a couple of botched launches. They tried to put solar sails into space, and they've got some problems. So the funding drops off with these people when things don't work out. Let me drop it. And, the other one wind up getting funding in Greece. His Bigelow, I mentioned that guy, he's the one that he wanted to put a... Well, in fact, he did put in put two small unmanned prototypes, inflatable, like, space hotels. That was his idea. I think he's, I don't know if he's still in the running. I think he's involved, but I don't know how he's being funded. And a couple more, I'm not going to read them all, but the main two, of course, now are SpaceX and Orbital Sciences has a shot with their Dream Chaser, similar to a space shuttle, but a lot smaller, no cargo space. Back to you.
Okay, lots of companies, lots of competition, and that's the way to let it all shake out and find out who is the leader, and I guess SpaceX was it for the time being. I'm amazed that they came up with more funding and got ahead of an organization like Virgin Atlantic, along with Rutan. Those two guys have got one hell of a good track record. Kind of amazed that they didn't come out on top. Now, when it comes to this magnetic clutch mechanism, when have you had a chance to magnetic particle clutch? When have you had a chance to see that Warner product and see that catalog on that? For those who want to see what we're talking about, I'll give you the website, which you can find on Bernie's website by going to huntfamily.com, Bernie@huntfamily.com, but you can also go directly to it by going to www.warnernet, warnernet.com/everything now is uppercase Papa Delta Foxtrot /Papa1207.PapaDeltaFoxtrot. You go to that particular website and you'll see this beautiful data sheet on this magnetic clutch mechanism. And I wonder if you figured out how that works, John. I think I have. And as I said before, it's one of my puzzles. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, this is not a new device. It's been used for quite a few years. And if we look at the publications of newspapers, that's a broadsheet. And tension is one of the most important things, because we're dealing with a piece of paper, 3/1 of an inch thick. It's a broadsheet, maybe 40 inches wide. The roll weighs about 2,000 pounds. You get an idea of how much inertia. And it goes through formers and rollers and compensators. And all of that tension has to be exact. And they use those. One of the companies, Baumuller in Germany, has used them on presses. and how I think they work. I mean, they're installed everywhere, but I never took one apart. But I think they use the ferrous product that's inside where those discs are rotating. When the coil gets magnetized, those pellets, particles, create the magnetic field necessary to impress a retardation on those spinning discs. And that's how I think they maintain tension. The best part of it is instantaneous control, almost instantaneous, where you cannot afford to have tension coming on and coming off, especially if you have a roll that is elliptical. And now the advance speed is accelerating and then overfeeding and overrunning the paper. The tension rollers are going crazy, and it's very important to maintain perfect tension. That's what we use them for. Over to you, Dick, for your explanation how you think they work.
Okay, as I apply more current to the coil and I create a stronger magnetic field, you're saying the magnetic field between the rotor and the stator, and those magnetic particles are in between magnetic spheres, it looks like magnetic powder. It's a bunch of fine magnetic spheres as sort of a black powder that's between the rotor and the stator, and there's a very close spacing between the two. You're saying that the magnetic particles fill up the space and create magnetic retardation, hysteresis effect. You believe that that's what's causing the drag. Is that what you said, John? Because if so, I think that's not what it is. Over to you, John.
I believe that is what it is, Dick, but you probably have a better idea. Like I said, I never took one apart or studied it, but that's how I thought they worked.
Okay, this is a science experiment that has been quite often demonstrated in real good science classes, both in high school and in college. Make believe I have a 1-inch diameter tube, could be copper or aluminum. I said 1-inch diameter? Yeah, let's make it 1-inch diameter. 1-inch diameter tube out of copper, and it is almost 2 feet long. Across the bottom of this tube, I place a piece of Kleenex, and I fold the Kleenex across the bottom up to the up along the sides of the tube, and I wrap a rubber band around it. So now the Kleenex is around the bottom of this tube. So it's a 1-inch diameter, inside diameter tube, and I have in my hand a 3/4-inch diameter dowel that is 2 feet long. The copper or aluminum tubing is 1 foot long. I've got in my hand and it's 1 inch inside diameter. I have in my hand a 3/4-inch diameter wooden dowel that's 2 feet long. And it's obvious that if I push the dowel inside the piece of tubing, it would probably require about 3 or 4 ounces of force for me to pierce through the tissue paper at the bottom, and it would pierce right through it with that dowel. So far, are you with me?
Yes.
Okay. If now, before I pierce that piece of tissue paper, I pour enough fine-grained sand into the tubing so that the sand comes up, let's say, 6 inches. I put an ounce worth of sand into the tubing. It comes up 6 inches. And now I put the 3/4-inch diameter dowel back into the tube, and I start pushing down on the sand. Tell me what you think will happen.
Sand's going to act like a lubricant, but it's going to give you drag.
If you actually do that experiment, you mount the 1-inch diameter piece of tubing in some kind of a collet mechanism in a vise, so it's really being held steady and being held vertical. And now with that dowel, I could probably push 200 pounds vertically, and I would not pierce that tissue paper at the bottom. Does that amaze you? Go ahead.
I'm not following the construct there.
Okay, the empty aluminum piece of tubing, aluminum piece of tubing, 1 inch inside diameter with tissue paper at the bottom, held in some kind of a vise so it's held vertical, held very steady. I got a 3/4-inch diameter dowel in my hand that's longer than the tube. If I simply push the dowel down there, I pierce through the tissue paper very easily. But instead of directly pushing through the piece of tissue paper with the 3/4-inch diameter dowel, I put 6 inches worth of fine-grained sand. I pour the sand down the inside of the piece of tubing,
the tissue paper is stopping it from falling out. So I've now got tissue paper in the